But getting back to what I did, I'm a member of the Plastic Pioneers Association. And these are the people who have to undergo a rigorous evaluation of what they did before they become members. It's limited to 250. And these are the people who really started the plastic industry. So
what's going to become of the society when...
We keep on getting new members in. As the old ones die, there's a waiting list.
Will there be pioneers still?
Hopefully. But whatever. I came up with not an original idea, certainly, that we wanted to get the history of these people before they died. And to make a very long story short, we formed a committee, the governing board approved it, and one of our members, a very big publisher in the field, suggested we go to the Chemical Heritage Foundation, because collecting doesn't mean a thing if you can't use it. And you need state-of-the-art computers, state-of-the-art programmers, a heck of a lot of money, a desire to love history, and everything that I said is 100% in the Chemical Heritage Foundation. So we are now collecting this. This is part of it. And we hope that we've already gotten the Society of Plastics Engineers interested in it and they're working with us. And we hope to cover the whole gamut of the American plastics scene. Then, with our experience, transfer the information to Europe, the Middle East, and the Far East, and hope they would do the same. So that's kept me very, very busy. And it's a very interesting thing, and you learn an enormous amount of things that you would never believe happened. And somebody had to invent something like a plastic tissue box. And these are the people who invented things. Dewey is a classic example. All of these people, Frank Nissel that you talked to, Glenn Beall, he was the first one who brought design into plastic. Before we just wanted to make this, it was in metal, you make it in plastic. He created the design idea in plastic, and so on. Another thing that I did do was my book was so successful with Wiley, the publisher, that they wanted an authoritative plastic handbook. And they finally conned me into doing it because I didn't need the money and it's a big job. And what I did is I got together the best people in the industry. I went through a 32,000 list of members of the SPE. I selected 15. I sent them the same note, "Dear Sir, I selected you out of 32,000 people with 14 others because of what you can do, your intelligence, your ability, etc. And I'd like you to join me with this as the Board of Governors, of Directors." And 13 said yes, two had good reasons for saying no. Smartest people I ever met. And it was a delight. And what we did is we went through handbooks. The trouble with handbooks is helter-skelter information. You never know what you're going to find or whether you'll find it or where we're finding it. So we came up with the idea of, say, plastic material. The name of it, the chemical name, how it's made, its advantages, its disadvantages. Say, if you want to know the advantages, you look at Section 7 and every one. And we went to the top people. In other words, if we wanted to know about nylon, we went to DuPont and asked them to give us an author. And we did the same thing in processing. And as one guy wrote to me, it's a handbook to end all the handbooks. And it's remarkably useful, and it sold very well. It's selling very well as well. It's a big thing, over $200. As a matter of fact, that's a red book over there. Mm-hmm. You can see.
Tell me something about your work with the Society of Plastic Engineers.
As I mentioned before, once we formed the New York section, I was one of the speakers, and we eventually developed the seminar program. But I, aside from being president of the New York section, I had no interest whatsoever in any of their political aspirations. In other words, I didn't want to be a national officer or anything like that. And I had a number of activities, but some of the main ones were that I was chairman of the National Publications Committee, which took care of all the publications. And it was a privately run organization by the professionals, and we opened it up, and we made a lot of improvements in it. And that's a two-year term, and I had a two-year term immediately following that as the chairman of the Technical Volumes Committee. We were in charge of creating new volumes. And in my tenure, we either started or completed 12 volumes of plastic books, including mine. And the end of our reign, the executive director started harassing us you have to have an operations manual, cha 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 cha, and none of these men were interested in manuals. What we had in mind was publishing maybe 20 books through publishers, then we got to know the field, do our own publishing, because all of the writers essentially came from SBE. So those were my major contributions there. But I was I knew all the people, offering advice, suggestions, because one of the things that, if people really asked me what I did in business, I would say two things. I made money and I thought, because I'm a collector of facts, and then if you think about them long enough, a pattern emerges, and then you begin to see things very clearly, and then you test it out. And I would come up with quite a number of new ideas which enhanced the plastic, Society of Plastic Engineers. And at this particular moment, the president of the SPE and I have been discussing various ways to increase the membership and so on and so forth. I was also made a fellow of the society, which is an honor given to people who are outstanding in the field of plastic, in their particular field. And I was given a fellow as a member because of my work in injection molding. I've been a member of the society for over 50 years. I'd like to talk for a very brief time about the plastic industry. The plastic industry was made by men who never asked, can you make a part? They asked, how you can make a part. And they did what was really unimaginable. Is that the right word?
Yes.
Okay. If you divide history into 50-year periods, there has been no 50-year period in history compared to the 50 years from 1950 to 2000 where the way we live has changed. Everything that we've done. You could not recognize it. For example, woman's lib would not be possible. My mother, she had to go to the butcher and the grocer and the fruit store, the vegetable store, and the bakery, and the drug store. Then she had to take the food, prepare it, cook it. Now, because of plastic packaging, everything is there. You can buy it. You don't even have to cook anymore. You can just heat. And that, with things like plastic diapers, wash and wear clothing. I remember my mother on a washboard in the sink, washing, then she had to hang it out to dry, then she spent hours ironing the clothes. Today we have wash and wear, which is not only stain resistant, but you just throw it in the machine and take it out. This gave women the time to have a job, raise kids, because women will always raise children, and have a husband if they wanted. You could not have done this without plastic. And you take any field, you take the medical field, for example, hospital infection has been cut down to approximately 20% of what it was because everything is now disposable. Disposable sheets, disposable silverware, disposable everything. Syringes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And take just a very simple thing. When my mother had a cataract removed, they put in a piece of glass held in a metal holder, and she had to lie on her back for 2 weeks with a weight compressing her eye so that the body can grow around the heavy piece of glass and metal. Now, I had a cataract done. In 12 and a half minutes, the pupil was out, a piece of plastic, acrylic lens went in, and the acrylic lens is held by a polypropylene holder about the thickness of your hair. And in 12 and a half minutes, I went from virtually blind, where I thought my doctor's assistant in his office was an American Indian who turned out to be a bleached blonde. I went from that to a correctable 20/20 vision. And these are just some of the minor miracles wrought by plastic. And I can't imagine, for me, any possible vocation that was so rewarding. It was difficult, it was hard work. Many times you're really up a tree and you're aggravated. But it was a wonderful learning experience. We met the most wonderful people. They're our best friends, the people in the plastic industries, as you see with Dewey. And it was just a great experience. Would I recommend it to my children? No. It's too damn competitive now. But you can do it. But, you know, there are many better things you can do. Assuming that the idea of business is primarily to make money. You can make money better ways than you can in the plastic industry.
You mentioned your children. Tell me something about your children.
Well, as I mentioned about my son, and he married a lawyer, now he's a lawyer. They have two children, both of which had early admission. The girl had early admission to University of Pennsylvania. She's now a sophomore. And the boy is just graduating high school and has early admission to Columbia. And our daughter is a full-time mother. She lives out on Long Island. And we have a an 8-year-old Tootsie, as cute as a button.
Yes.
And since she was 4, she was working on my computer. And I bought her a program about 3 months ago, a brand new one, and I couldn't get out of the bloody thing. So she said, why don't you hit edit? And I did in there, and she got out. Yeah, it's just amazing what the computer does. 8 going on 45.
Mm-hmm.
And we just went away last weekend, you know, during the holiday week, President's Week, with the whole family. And we have a great time. Her husband's a hell of a nice guy. We get along beautifully. And that's where we are with the family. I have a brother who's got a PhD in theoretical physical chemistry. And he was a teacher in the graduate school at Brooklyn Poly. He taught at NYU. And he decided what he wanted to do was to solve difficult problems. So he looks for some difficult problems. His company is Optimal Analysis. And then he gets the best people, like Ken Arrow. He had a project checking out the oil for the Congress, the oil Congress had him review the oil program of the United States, what we should do with oil, how we should get oil, and so on. And he hired people like Ken Arrow, the Nobel Prize winner in economics, and so on, to do the job. And I'll give you two things, one of which is very interesting. When we evacuated Vietnam, one of the big planes, the door fell off, the plane fell into the water, people were killed. And the Navy wanted to know, was it a failure of the door, was it a failure of design, and so on. So they sent Navy ships to try to get it up, because they had a vague idea where it was. And the captain wires back where, you know, it's a big place in the Pacific Ocean. So they called my brother in, could he tell him where? And he says, no way you're going to find it. Well, they said, try it. We got to try a spot. So they gave him the winds, the tide, the airspeed, the whole bit. They put it into a game program, and they came out with a spot. The ship got there, dropped its grapple hook right onto the door. And instead of getting all kinds of kudos from the government, the guys who contracted him says, we knew you could do it all the time. Why did you give us such a hard time? And now he is interested in this, and he's got government contracts. The teachers don't know their right hand from their left foot in teaching physics to young kids. And if you don't teach physics to grade school children, they'll never go anywhere. And you can't understand the world today without understanding physics. So they've developed a wonderful program of teaching physics by using readily available things and with all kinds of teacher backups. First they teach the teacher, literally, and the teacher comes to courses, and it's been very successful, and they're now looking to negotiate where they can really market this whole thing or give it out free if the government wants to pay for it. It's really not apropos to go into the many experiments, but let's leave it at that.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you think we should include in the story for now? I know that there are...
In collecting the history of the PPA members and other people, the question of artifacts. I have a half a garage full of plastic parts. And the thought of collecting all the artifacts expanded in my mind to collecting all the parts made, as many of parts as possible made in the United States, and have an enormous database. You have a database like that, you could give via CDs a visual museum to every class in the country. And you collect the parts, you can set up museums in every college, high school, public school, and so on. But the thought of physically collecting all those parts was enormous, beyond our capacities both physically and financially, until about a few years ago when digital cameras came on. So now we could collect the pictures of the parts, and by knowing what we want, get it all online, digitally, so we don't have to handle anything. And if there's a part we want collected for a museum exhibit, just ask the person to give it to us. I've spoken to the Chemical Heritage Foundation because they're absolutely perfect for this, and they asked me to write a proposal, which I'm in the process of doing. The database has tremendous value. First of all, if you're in the plastic industry and you want a certain gear, instead of making it yourself at maybe a cost of $50,000 to $100,000, if you knew who else had it, they'd be more than glad to sell it to you because they'd be making money and removing a competitor. So that has a great impact in that way. If you're designing something and you could buy a database of all the parts like that, which would certainly help you in your design. If you were a child and you had a CD-ROM with all the toys made last year and a $50 check from your grandfather, pick one out and buy it. And there's just, medically, there are enormous opportunities here. Because if you take the history of plastic parts, you have the history of the United States. Because, I don't mean the political history, but the history of the United States, because the plastic is the second largest material we use, third or fourth largest employer. And it's going to be impossible for people to make intelligent decisions about their environment, their life, without really knowing about plastic. And it's, you know, we had a big problem to get plastic lenses replacing glass. But if people understood that you can be blinded if you get hit with a broken eyeglass and glass, and you won't with your eye protected with plastic, if people had that knowledge, you wouldn't have had all that problem. The same thing about plastic pipe. Everybody uses in the world plastic pipe, except now New York State, because the plumbers union doesn't want to be out of a job. And the plumbers union, in my opinion, contribute a lot to members of the governing bodies in New York City and New York State. So, again, educating people in plastic becomes a very important part, and a database like this, where you can get any information you want, would be of tremendous value. Okay. That is part of the reasons, I suppose, that I got into the Hall of Fame. And I'm not only somebody who can come up with an idea, but I don't believe ideas are worth much unless you put them into practice. And I was known as a doer, and I've been chairman of a lot of committees. Every one of them has been quite successful. The simple reason I look upon myself as a chairman, not the boss. And I'm the executive arm of the committee, and I do what they say. And even if I disagree, which happens on occasion, when they come to a decision, I follow it as if it were my own, because I've learned that two heads are better than one, and six heads is certainly better than one. And it's worked out. That's why I got the handbook done so easily, why this plastic history project is going, and many other things. Because the people who work with me know that their information, their input counts. You know, they're just not on there for their good looks. When I was writing my book on injection molding, I wanted to find out the physical characteristics of molding machines. So I left my card at all the molding machinery manufacturers' exhibits, and they would always send somebody to see me. So I'd quickly see them and explain to them the reason I wanted it, and they would say thank you and send me any additional information. One guy comes in, and just for the heck of it, I asked him how much is a 2.5-inch, 300-ton machine. He says, I don't know. I said, how come you're trying to sell me a machine? You don't even know what they cost. He said, I'm not. He said, I'm a canvasser. I go and talk to you and see if you're really interested, and if you are, I set up a meeting with a sales engineer. I said, what do you know about plastic machinery? He said, I never saw one. I said, come on out. I thought I'd show him, 5 minutes. It ended with one of my one-hour lectures on how molding machines work. When he left, he thanked me profusely. He said, I feel a lot better now when I go in. About 15 minutes later, I get a call from a company called Lesney Products. You know what Matchbox cars are? They're these little metal cars. And they were the American arm of the British company. It's a British company. Could I make a holder? They had a holder of 12 plastic cards. I said, yeah. He said, when can you see me? I said, I don't know. If it's in Alaska, if you're in Alaska, it'll take me a couple of days. Where the hell are you? He was 5 minutes away. So I said, I'll be up in about half an hour. Is that okay? He said, fine. He showed me this box. I looked at it. and we have a picture of it, and he said he needs about 5 million of them. That's 60 million things. When I hear 5 million, I always jump back, and when I hear 100,000, I know I have a customer. So I looked at it. I knew the cost of material. He gave me the cost of material, actually. He gave me the weight. I figured the material cost. I figured my cycle on a 4-cavity mold. So you'd have like 4 pieces of paper. It was almost this size, 8.5 by 11. And I gave him the price. I didn't tell him how many cavities. He says, I don't believe it. He said, in England, they can only make 1 at a time. And I've had other quotes, and the maximum they'll make is 2 at a time. I said, I withdraw my quote. Let me look at it. So I did, and I could see no reason on God's earth why I couldn't make 4 at a time. So I said, what I'll do is I'll raise my price 10%, because I could be wrong. I will guarantee you 500,000 pieces at my price. And if I can only run 2, then you'll have an extra 2 cavities to make another mold. He said, wait a minute. And he looked up my D&B, which would certainly cover that. And he said, very good idea. Let me think about it. I said, you got 10 minutes. He said, what are you talking about? I said, you're not going to know anything more in 11 minutes than you're going to know in 10 minutes. Now, either you want me to do the job, and I'll take it. If not, forget it and give it to your 2 cavity guys. He says, it's a hell of a way to do business. I said, that's right, but you're doing it with a hell of a business. So he gave me the job. I gave a rough quote, and I quoted him about 26 weeks delivery, and he was very upset. He said, he's got to have it faster. I said, look, I'm not going to lie to you. I'll try to make it as fast as I can, but the way this looks, it might take that time. I get back to the office. I call up Rogério, my buddy in Portugal. I tell him the whole story. He knew what I was talking about because they have matchbox cars mm-hmm. there. He said, come on over. So I got on the 4 o'clock plane that afternoon, and next morning I was in Marina Grande. And we sat down. He called the whole conference of all his design engineers in the drawing room. Nobody could see why it shouldn't work. So I went back. About 8 weeks later, incredibly, he calls me up and says, sit down. I said, what's up? He said, the mold is done. I said, so how does it run? He said, I've got good news and I've got bad news. He said, the good news is it runs 240 shots an hour. And I had only figured about 90. And you're going to need 2 operators. I said, that's the bad news. No, he said, that's the good news. Let me start all over again. He said, the good news is it runs beautifully at 240 shots an hour. And the bad news, he says, you're going to use at least 2 operators, maybe 3. I said, I love you tenderly. So he said, you want to come out and see it? I said, do I have to? He says, you really don't. So next morning, was on a TWA plane. And about a day later, it was in my machine. And I walk into him about 11 weeks later, and I throw the parts on his desk, and I said, look, he almost dropped. And he came down to the place, he saw us running, but there was one problem. There are 12 compartments, and 2 of the main dividers, they had a bend in them. They weren't absolutely straight. He didn't see it at first. I said, we have to work this out. He says, you're a dead man if you try. He says, I have to have it. The real problem with the job was, number one, you couldn't stack them. So when you ran around the clock, if they didn't take them out the next day, you had to stop production. So we arranged with the superintendent that we would take the stuff down and, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning, and we hired a guard to stand outside because we had a whole street covered with boxes, and we had polyethylene plastic on top in case it was raining. And then we had one person had to regrind the whole runner, so we ordered actually 4 more molds. We just kept 2, and we had them give out 2 to somebody else. And the real answer here was, I'm sitting at an SBE meeting next to ESSO, people who were selling polypropylene, and they asked me, polyethylene, and he asked me if he could get the order. I said, sure, give me a price. He said, well, what price do you want? I said, I'm a nothing, and you're the biggest company in the world. You tell me the price. I had figured 22 cents with the coloring. He comes up with a price of 9 cents a pound colored. I didn't know at the time that they had a warehouse full of stuff they hadn't started producing yet, and they bought it from another supplier, and they didn't know what to do with it. So I gave him the order, and we used an awful lot of stuff. And with the extra molding cost, I tacked on 10% and running it almost 2.5 times faster. and that material price, I made a huge bundle. Rich Leslie knew of that, and they didn't care at all, because I never kept a secret from a customer.
Mm-hmm.
We eventually straightened out the part. What was happening is we were packing in too much material, but we don't have time for the long story, and we didn't need the six gates we had. We only needed two, or four, two on each end. So when we plugged up those two gates, it ran like a charm. And they're still running to this day. Well, you know, I gave up the job a while back. Another good customer was Ampro Machine Products. They were recommended to me by General Electric, who made Lexan. They had made a Lexan pump, and the pump wouldn't work. But before I had done that, I didn't know that they were recommending me. We were not busy in lamp parts in October, November, December, because lamps were shipped before then. So I went into the Yellow Pages to look for somebody who would be selling stuff in the spring and summer, so they would be manufacturing in our slow months. They came upon swimming pools. So I went to the library in Manhattan, a big public library. I got out all the literature, and I found out the problem was they were using die casting stuff. And when Monsanto, who made the chlorinating stuff for the pool, would change the formula, the die-cast stuff would start to be attacked chemically. So I went and I bought a small pump, and I had my model maker make a sample out of ABS, which at that time was perfect for the job. And I brought it to this guy, Stanley Huppert, H-U-P-P-E-R-T, at Ampro. And I had not known that the Lexan guy was there before me. And I said, here's a pump that will never corrode. I said, test it out and call me in a week. Here's my card. I walk out. He says, hey, where are you going? I said, here is a pump which will never corrode. Test it out. Here's my card. Call me in a week. I said, shall I repeat it again? And he started to laugh. And they tested it. They threw in nails and rocks and everything else. And he gave me an order for that pump. Then, after about 6 weeks of running the pump with every possible thing in it, they tripled the amount of chlorinating things. He gave me an order for about four or five different items. And the net result of that was that he had 2 years ahead of everybody else because he guaranteed it would not corrode. And the cost in a swimming pool is if it corrodes, it's a very expensive thing for the swimming pool seller to have it fixed. They have to empty the pool, et cetera, et cetera. So we had a 2 year jump, and we made many one of the original things for him, like polycarbonate, which we molded for him. They never tried molding polycarbonate in a very small gate. It used to be a huge gate. Technically, I could see no reason why not. So I called up my boys at GE, and they said, you know more about it than I do, than they do, to try it and let us know. So we did, and it worked. And that's how they got small gating on polycarbonate parts. We had a long, wonderful relationship. Unfortunately, he died young of a heart attack, and his wife took over and did very well. And we're still friendly with the wife, and very friendly with his production manager, the one who ran his plant. The last one that I want to talk about is Clinique. They're part of Estee Lauder, the so-called Cadillac of the cosmetic industry, and deservedly so. They came up with an item for a mascara applicator where it was a rectangular part with a sleeve, and inside the sleeve was a drawer, and in the drawer they put the mascara and the brush, and they wanted to metal plate the outside of the sleeve so that the woman could use that as a mirror, because she only has two hands. She needs one hand for a mirror, one hand for the stuff, and one hand for the applicator. So they tried making it, and they couldn't get the fit to work right. The molder blamed the plater blamed the molder. So they called in, they're ready to give the job up, and Borg Warner, who made the plastic material, told them to call either me or the metal plater. And together they said we could solve this problem. The metal plater was Nick Annis of Plated Plastic Products, whom I had been, we were one of the first molders of ABS that could be metal plated, and we were good friends as well through SBE. And he called me up and he said, "Did you get a call from Marma?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You want to go?" I said, "Why don't you go?" He said, "You're a better salesman." I said, "Okay." He said, "Do you want to have a, do I mind if I can have his new salesman, which he just hired, go and learn the business?" I said, "Fine." So I make this crazy nut. He keeps me waiting for 20 minutes. And we're driving, and he doesn't talk. So I ask him my favorite question, "What do you do for a hobby? What hobbies do you have?" He says, "I have two hobbies. One is women, and the other is I can predict people's character by their name."